Hi, I'm Chris Nessie from the House of EdTech podcast, a proud member of the Education Podcast Network, just like the show you're listening to right now. The opinions expressed are those of each individual host. And make sure to check out all the other great podcasts at edupodcastnetwork.com. And now, the learning begins in 3, 2, 1.
Hey, today I'm talking with Ryan Schaff. We're focused on his book, Game On, Using Digital Games to Transform Teaching, Learning, and Assessment. Lots to learn today. This is all about bringing game-based learning into the classroom. Check it out. Hey, have you heard the new music for my show? It's called Microcosm, and it's written, produced, and played by Dr. Lodge McCammon. You can find out more at lodgemccammon.com. Thanks, Lodge.
You are listening to Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12, a podcast for educators, helping you help kids achieve their dreams. And now here's Steve with this week's show.
Ryan Schaff is an author, speaker, professor, consultant, and blogger. Ryan has written and published 4 books, Making School a Game Worth Playing, Digital Games in the Classroom, co-authored with Nikki Moan, Corwin 2014, Using Digital Games as Assessment and Instruction Tools, Solution Tree 2015, Reinventing Learning for the Always On Generation, Strategies and Apps at Work, Solution Tree 2015, and his latest, Game On, Using Digital Games to Transform Teaching, Learning, and Assessment, Solution Tree 2017. Ryan also has published research articles related to using digital games in the classroom and New Horizons for Learning in the Canadian Journal of Action Research. Ryan is a full-time professor at Notre Dame of Maryland University and an adjunct instructor for the Johns Hopkins School of Education. Ryan has more than 18 years of experience in the field of education. He was a public school and teacher, instructional leader, curriculum designer, and technology specialist in Maryland. In 2007, Ryan was nominated for the Maryland Teacher of the Year Award. Please welcome Ryan Schaff, author of Game On, Using Digital Games to Transform Teaching, Learning, and Assessment, to the show. Say hi to everyone, Ryan.
Hi, everybody. Thanks for having me.
Ryan, welcome back. Last time we talked, we were focused on your book, Reinventing Learning for the Always Turned On Generation. Today, we're talking about your latest book written with Nikki Moan, Game On, Using Digital Games to Transform Teaching, Learning, and Assessment, from Solution Tree Press in 2017. In the introduction of Game On, this is stated: continuous digital bombardment has caused students to learn, communicate, and play differently than the ways their parents and today's educators did. Could you talk a little bit about this? What do you mean?
Absolutely. Let's go back about 15 years or so, and brain scientists determined that there's this mental phenomenon known as neuroplasticity. It's the ability for the brain to constantly reorganize its neural pathways. And this is what it kind of ties into when I'm talking about continuous digital bombardment. We have a constant stream of information, both digital and non-digital. Now, of course, it's more digital than ever before. And we're finding that this is actually restructuring our brains to the point now where we learn in completely different ways than past generations. I'm still like a member of the analog generation. I remember growing up without computers in my house. But of course, when I went into the high school, when I went into college, I started to have access to computers, not in my house, but I obviously had them at some schools, and I had access to them at college and in libraries. But now access is obviously everywhere. And of course, now we're going through digital bombardment where my sons could, if I wasn't a person that would monitor their media diet, they'd be on their screens constantly, receiving all that information, which is, again, there's a lot of negativity with that, and I tend to agree that too much of a good thing can be bad. However, just like how we take in our food, our diet, a balance of everything is just fine, and we're able to take in content, take in information quite differently than we have in the past, and it's creating such amazing opportunities for learning.
Very cool. That's, you know, and it's funny because you're so right. I mean, there's so many different ways now. I spend a lot of time trying to figure out how to do things on YouTube. I actually don't know what I'd do without it now. And just that alone has changed the way I approach problem solving.
Yeah, it's called just-in-time learning, and YouTube is probably one of the best tools when it comes to a connected educator, because they can learn, and it's also for a connected learner as well. Educators can use them as obviously instructional tools, which I go into in my other book, Reinventing Learning. But learners can also learn how to do it using, you know, if they want to do things and they want to cut out teachers, if they just want to learn something on themselves, they can. My son usually turns to YouTube to watch a clip to learn how to do something. For instance, if he wanted to learn how to skateboard, he might watch a video on how exactly they do it. It's just a different mindset. Yeah, and of course there's the actual experience, but this is kind of like doing their research. They do a lot more research before they do things, and or they get ideas from videos that they watch.
Yeah, it's cool. It's a different sort of way of doing research. I mean, I think that you know, because it kind of lends itself to fun. Of course, yeah. It also lends itself to, you know, when I was working on my doctorate, I would get lost in the history and start finding things, my advisor would say, "Would you stay on track? Quit finding other interesting things."
Yeah, we have to understand is our generations are really text trained. Where this generation and the generations that have come after us, they're more light and sound trained now. So we have to understand that when we create our educational resources for them.
Very cool. So in thinking about the teacher in the classroom, understanding the kids of today, there's this is in the book. It says the notion of the lonely gamer is an outdated concept. If so, do you think this is something important for a teacher to understand, and why do they need to recognize this?
The book really goes into using digital games for learning, and that there's a lot of this authentic learning that's going on. Because games are able to give you content in an active learning environment, and they're constantly assessing learners and also adjusting, almost doing an electronic type of scaffold where they're adjusting challenge levels for students. When it comes to what I mentioned about the lonely gamer is an outdated concept, we have to understand that the demographics of gamers has shifted tremendously over the last few decades. If you think about the preconceived notion of, you know, go ahead and try to mentally envision what you would see as a gamer, you would see a young boy or a teenage boy playing a video game in the dark at night, usually alone. Well, just like Luke Skywalker said in The Last Jedi, pretty much every single word in that statement is wrong. It's now we're looking at the female demographic is absolutely growing significantly faster than their male counterparts. There used to be, I think in 2008, there was a research article that mentioned that 99% of boys, adolescent boys and teenage boys, played video games. That's astounding. But then again, when it comes to girls, over 95% of them also played video games. That's not really thought of a whole lot. We weren't focusing on our female gamers. And now we have to understand the demographics is a lot more people are playing them. We have 2 billion gamers on the planet now. And that's pretty much 2 out of every 7 people on our planet. You know, these types of demographics are exciting because it almost goes, you know, they're astronomical numbers, extremely high. In the United States alone, over half of every household has a gaming system. I think about 60% of United States, the population of the United States actually play games. So these demographics are absolutely unbelievable and unheard of. And it's not just one person playing and another person playing. Now game systems and platforms allow for collaboration and competition. So now it's not just one person usually playing in their basement at night. They're usually collaborating with people online, and they're also gaming. It's almost become like social learning or like a collaborative effort where you'll have multiple people playing games simultaneously right next to each other or playing with other people across the globe. So gaming's demographics have changed significantly over the past couple decades because of just the change in access to technology and just the change in culture, demographics, and diversity.
Yeah, it's so amazing. I mean, I watch my own sons, and they're playing these multi-part games where they're online, they're connected with other people whose the names that are appearing on there are not just avatars that exist in the computer. I mean, they're in the game itself. They're out there, and that always amazes me that whoever that is out there that is leading the charge or is part of one of their teammates is sitting someplace else. It's a lot different than making Mario jump and bounce
yes,
to the
absolutely.
Golden boxes. So cool stuff. So in chapter one, as we start delving into the book, this is said, what we are proposing is that instead of viewing digital tools as competition to existing teaching, learning, and assessment models, a shift to an education 3.0 mindset should promote the use of these tools to support modern learning. Could you take a minute to share what education 3.0 mindset is and then explain the idea of viewing digital tools as a support for modern learning?
Sure. So let me kind of explain what 1, 2, and 3 when it comes to education. So education 1.0, if you think way back to when education was almost in its classic mode, the one-room schoolhouse, the very simple amounts of content within a curriculum, it really being really centered around religion or around agriculture and all this other stuff. It served its time. It served a portion of its population. But this is obviously it's very antiquated and two or three centuries old and even older than that. Then comes the shift to education 2.0. And this really came around during like the industrial age when now we were developing Model Ts and we actually saw factories. We had to standardize our curriculum. We had to have a one size fit all. This way we could guarantee that all of our all of our products, which were our students, were all the same. They had the same experiences. They understood the same content. They had the same skills to where it's almost like a factory line. To this day, a lot of schools, and I'm not saying all, this is definitely not a me condemning every single school, no. But some schools still have these that's the way we've always done it mentalities where they don't question the system that they currently teach in. Why do we have bells in schools? Why do we have, why do we have summers off? They don't question all these really long-standing practices. Now we have a shift. Digital technology has really been the disruptor to where now we have education 3.0, which is trying to change the system of school. Students are learning in different ways now. Schools are starting to transform. Now we have online courses. We have online schools. We have school choice. We have schools trying and exploring new types of teaching and learning and assessment. Education 3.0 tries to embrace this evolution in school and in learning. And gaming is much the same way. It is a different approach. It's not going to fit in a one-size-fit-all type of category. Games are created to where it helps with the audience because these designers really need to think about their player when it comes to it. If a game is developed and it's horrible, nobody's going to want to play it. However, if it's created and catered and they have to constantly find this way to make it hard enough for people to want to come back to play it, but not too hard to where they want to give up. They have to find that sweet spot of that game to where it's challenging, but it's not too much or it's not too easy. One of the main allures of gaming is it when they're playing, it's releasing that dopamine. That's why it's so attractive for players to keep on coming back for more because it's dopamine. It's a pleasure. It's a pleasure when we have that release in our brains, when that neurotransmitter is released in our brain. It's very pleasurable, and we want to keep on doing it. But the dopamine release isn't going to happen if it's too easy of a game or if it's too hard of a game. It has to be just right. And that keeps the kids coming back for more, and it keeps players. And I can't even say kids. To get back to the demographics, is the average age of a gamer in the United States right now is 35 years old. And nice. I'm not saying that more and more kids aren't playing games. That's absolutely – more and more kids are playing games because they have more access to them. It's just their parents aren't having that massive withdrawal. They're playing games with their kids now, or they're playing games by themselves, and they're not putting down the joysticks or the game controllers anymore. They keep on using them.
That's awesome. I'm sorry to interrupt. That's awesome because I think about it with I just know myself. I've tried playing some of the games with my kids, and they're older. There's this one driving game that I cannot play, the one where you have no walls, because I go off into infinity and it drives me nuts. Every blooming time I go to that corner, it's like, okay, I'm done.
I understand. My son has been trying to get me to play Pixel Gun forever and ever, and I find no interest in it because the graphics are very simple, and I just don't see the allure of the game. But I downloaded for a simple shoot 'em up game on my iPad called Alien Creeps, and it's a lot of strategy. You have to find ways, and it's my son's 10, so he can deal with a little bit of the violence, but it's not overly violent. You don't have lots of blood and gore, and it's just basically like almost cartoon types of a display of like anything, and it's just fun because you have to strategize how to save the planet Earth. Stuff like that I find is a lot of fun, and my kids, sometimes they pick games I like and sometimes they pick games I don't like, or sometimes they'll abandon games that I'm still having fun playing. It's very personalized sometimes when it comes to your game choice.
Gotcha. That's, and it's funny. I still like, I'm still stuck in the 80s. So I got my Asteroids, the earlier Marios and stuff like that. I'm good. We're getting some of this stuff.
I understand completely. I mean, that's why all those nostalgic game systems that are coming back out. My wife bought a Nintendo for me last year, and I still love to play it. My 4.5-year-old likes playing Tecmo Bowl. I didn't realize how hard that game is to actually play. It's just unbelievable. But he's really drawn to it because it's very simple. It's not like Madden 2018 where it's really just a matter of understanding the statistics. He just understands, here's a playbook and let me play it and let's see what happens. And he's getting clobbered by the computer, 66 to 6, and he can't believe it. But he still keeps on coming back for more, and he asks for that. He gets a little bit of screen time a day. He'll constantly ask for Tecmo Bowl. So, my 4.5-year-old likes a game from the 1980s.
Nice, nice. I'm there with him. Very good stuff. So let's talk a little bit about the gaming mindset. Can you tell us, because what I want to get to is to help teachers – because your book focuses on this whole idea, and it's so supportive of being able to help a teacher, prepare, develop lessons for bringing games and game learning into the classroom. Can you talk a little bit about the gaming mindset and how it relates to teachers making plans in the classroom?
Sure. One thing that my book does, that Game On does, is it tries to define vocabulary that might be out there. The one thing is you might hear the term game-based learning or gamification, and sometimes they're used almost interchangeably, and they're not. They're actually two different approaches to teaching and learning. Game-based learning is actually using a game to teach with, as in your students are learning content, they're learning through gameplay, whereas gamification is actually using gaming mechanics in situations that aren't a game. If you go to Starbucks and you belong to the reward system, where you know you get like 10 lattes and then the 11th one's free, or McDonald's Monopoly. Everybody's played Monopoly where they've gone and they bought and they're trying to collect all the little pieces. It's a game, but it's actually involved. You know, if you think about it, you don't need to play a game to eat your Big Mac. You just go there and you get these little, you know, rewards for buying a McDonald's food. You see gamification in other ways, like Foursquare, when you rate things on, you know, when you rate Uber and you give them ratings. Those are actual game mechanics. You're rating people in a 4 or 5 star. Where do you think they've gotten 4 or 5 star from? You know, for hotels and stuff, but it's also the game mechanics. It's, we have all these metrics now. We have all these elements of a game pushed, you know, just about everywhere. The military's used it. Corporate training has used these types of mechanics to try and these game mechanics to try and keep people and try to, I don't want to say control their behavior, but to help persuade them to do something. In McDonald's case, it's to try and buy more food and to play along with them. In Starbucks, it's to reward loyalty that they're coming to Starbucks, they're buying their drinks. I've seen it done in classrooms to where they've, you know, like for instance, an app like Class Dojo is a perfect example of gamification. You have avatars which become almost like their characters in this fictitious mental construct where, you know, they're this little avatar and they're constantly getting points for good behavior, or they're getting points for turning in their homework or walking in a straight line. So you get these points and you can ascend, you can increase your level. And so that's gamification. That is game mechanics outside of a game. It's just taking and using the properties of a game someplace else where there's not a game. So I wanted a different, now, you can do that, obviously, in schools. I could take a game, find a game, and develop instruction around the game, or I could use it as a supplement, or I could use it as homework. I could use it in all sorts of ways where my students are playing it, and they're learning through the gameplay, and I might be doing outside-of-game experiences with them to try and tie back to the ideas, the themes, and the connections and the skills that they're exploring in gameplay. However, I can also use gamification in the classroom. In fact, many teachers have used gamification without thinking about it. When they give rewards, or they give points, or they give table points for good behavior, they're actually doing some forms of gamification. If you have themes in your classroom, for instance, when I was a third grade teacher, we used to have these themes at the beginning of the school year just to try and get our students immersed in, and build community. We would sometimes pick pirates to where we would focus on pirates for the first almost like 2 months of school. We would do reading based on pirates. We would do math based on pirates, science and social studies based on pirates, and just having that kind of theme. That type of theme can also be considered a type of gamification, because you have this almost like the storyline, this narrative that is artificial, you know, and becomes very immersive for the students. We used to do the Titanic. We used to do the Loch Ness Monster. We used to do all these just fun and engaging activities, but it was like storyline based. It was narrative based. It helped get students creativity flowing, and it used to fuel their imaginations. So we do a lot of this type of gamification without thinking of it, but there's a lot of other elements too. There's giving students constant feedback. There's allowing them to fail up, or sometimes they even call it tinkering, where they actually explore things, and you know, students are learning not to fail. They're learning not for the grade. They're learning because they want to learn. Or mastery-based learning, to where you're not just teaching one concept. They may get it, they may not get it. Let me move on. You're teaching it until they master it, like a game. They're learning content until they've mastered it. Then they move on. So that almost like mastery-based instruction is also encouraged in that. there's also the types of scaffolds that are available, obviously the support it offers for students, and the way that information is actually displayed for students in a very visual way can be done in both game-based learning and gamification. So there's some elements they do share, but they are actually two different instructional strategies. They're two different gaming mindsets, I guess is the best way to say it.
Excellent. Appreciate you explaining that, especially because I think I've been very guilty of using those terms interchangeably, the gamification and game-based learning. So I appreciate you straightening me out there.
Oh, no, absolutely no problem. And many people still do. And that's and I find that a lot of the pundits, a lot of the experts, they really try and they try to clarify, but they're so stuck in their mindsets. They're like, oh, well, this is easy. It's clear as day. This is different. Yeah, it's just one of those things that have really just become very ubiquitous, and it's just a misconception. It just has to be defined and giving clear definitions for. And that's what Game On does. It gives those types of definitions and shows very specific ways of how it looks in the classroom, and it differentiates them.
Very cool. So in Chapter 4, readers learn in Game On, they learn how to find and evaluate digital games for teaching, learning, and assessment. I love this chapter. It has great ideas. Can you talk a little bit about understanding how to be choosy when evaluating games to use with kids?
It's hard to make that decision of what a good learning game is and what a good learning game isn't. I take a look at three types of strategies or topics or whatever. Really, there's three themes, and there's one is how it addresses whatever you're trying to teach, as in curriculum and content. The second one is the learning and assessment process, how you are actually going to teach with the game, or how the students are going to learn from the game, and how you're going to assess that learning. And three, of course, is the technical aspects, how you're going to deliver the game to them, how they're going to play the game. Are they going to do this one-on-one? Are they going to do this in small groups? Are they going to do this as a center because you only have one device in the classroom that will support the game? How is it going to be used? Is the game good, of good quality? Are the graphics nice? And yes, graphics and the quality of sound and stuff like that is absolutely important for this type of gameplay. If you see a very cheap game with that looks like it's very poorly designed, the player is going to realize that. They're not going to get involved with it. They're not going to become immersed in the gameplay. They're going to see that it's a fractured or a flawed type of system. They don't want to do it. I'm not saying everything has to be of quality of Avatar. What I'm saying is it has to be produced in a professional manner. That is, that it's they don't see the flaws that we would see, because we can tell the difference between something that's professionally done and something that is just created quickly in almost like a rough draft state. So there's a lot of different components, and I actually include like a pretty in-depth checklist of ways to kind of determine a good game. The most important thing I can say is play the game yourself as an educator. See if you can come in and involved. Pilot the game, as in find a couple students to play with, or find, you know, your children to play with at home. Seeing if, you know, play and talk to them and say, you know, this does a good job of this, or this does a good job of that. A great example I have is everybody, you know, my age, and Stephen, your age too, played Oregon Trail. It's like one of the very first experiences we had with gaming in, or actually just computers in general in education. I did this, was it in the 1980s?
I remember that game.
It was on the old Apples. Well, years later, they've had all of these different versions of Oregon Trail, and still to this day, it actually does have quite a bit of social studies applications to it. Well, they had a release on the iPad called Oregon Settler, which was kind of a mix of Oregon Trail and almost like the Farmville Facebook type of game, where instead of just traveling around from place to place, you actually develop your own town in in Oregon, you know, in the time of the Oregon Trail. You develop it, and it's, again, it's all the same, you know, it's all that present day technology, all the present day history. You get to incorporate a lot, and there's just so many different skills and concepts embedded in that. You have social studies applications, obviously, with the history involved and the technology that they used and the problems that they had and the challenges that they had to overcome. You have the potential for, of course, English and reading. There's a lot of dialogue in that is authentic dialogue that they were talking. They're not talking formal English like that we're used to using nowadays. They're talking in a dialect from another time, so that they have to almost decipher this and understand exactly what it's saying. There's potential for creative writing. There's a potential for, like economics, because you actually have to manage money and manage natural resources in this gameplay. And it seems like, just at the first glance, like they were trying to get some sort of nostalgic pop. But it's great because it's very simple. It has a great storyline that's very simple to get immersed in. And it just goes to show that a game, you have to play it. And I played it with my oldest son, and I showed a couple students that I did a workshop with, and they absolutely loved the game, to where they said, I'll play this at home. And guess what? It was rated something like 7 and up, so obviously it's safe. The content, there's not a lot of – there's really no violence. Instead of I don't even think they hunt. They fish. so it's not that even like trying to shoot 200 pounds of food anymore and only being able to take 50 pounds back. It's just – that doesn't exist. It's just you're fishing, and you do you actually raise cattle instead, to where before – and, you know, there's nothing butchering. You just end up raising cattle, and you take care of them. You have to watch them and monitor their health and stuff. And you can sell and barter all these things, all these ideas and concepts from back then, all immersed in a great storyline. Absolutely wonderful for elementary education students.
That's awesome. And I know that, you know, in looking, and that's what I think is so cool about this chapter, is that that checklist that you talked about just gives a teacher the opportunity. You know, here's the idea, you know, look for these things, and here's some things, you know, so it gives them food for thought in what they're, you know, as they're considering. And I love what you just said about get a couple kids to try something out. You know, for any teacher who's ever tried a game in the classroom, period, that would have been great advice for that, you know, because you find out what you left out of the rules or something like that, and the kids will call you on. Well, I think it makes perfect sense for any of the video games, for any of these types of games, if you're going to add them to your lessons and such, to kind of bring some in and get them to try it to see if it actually will engage them or not.
Yeah, I never suggest trying to do something without testing it first, especially on a full class implementation. It's always nice to see and experience it in like a small amount. This way, you have a very forgiving audience of one or two kids or three kids that are or you know, students or learners that are like saying, yeah, you know, we understand that you're testing, experimenting this. They appreciate that. They want to help you to do that. So piloting is usually very helpful.
Excellent. The readers are introduced to lesson design and some awesome tools that you have called Lesson Sparks. Can you talk us through this just a little bit?
Sure. When I'm reading books or looking online for instructional resources, a lot of people end up creating lesson plans. Well, lesson plans, different districts, different states, different counties, different provinces, they end up having their own types of lesson plan format, and I really don't want to get into the nuts and bolts of I have to do absolutely everything specifically the way that everybody else does it. So what I do is instead I like to give readers, educators, ideas for integrating games. So what I do is I provide this format called a lesson spark. It's not a lesson plan. It's not full blown out. It does have a lot of the components of a lesson plan. It talks about the game. It introduces a game, talks about what standards it might address, an objective that you might write based on playing this game, and the ideas that are incorporated around the gameplay, what you do to introduce the game, how you how your students might play the game, or you know what dynamic goes into the gameplay in the classroom or in the learning environment. And then also what happens after gameplay, how that's reflected upon, how that's processed, how you can gather evidence of student performance and that they've learned what you wanted to learn during the gameplay. So there's an empty template of it online, and this kind of ties in, I'm sure, to the next question you're going to ask is you know, what resources does the book
yes.
Give you? The Lesson Sparks, I provide a few examples inside the book. I wanted to provide like three examples to where this way there's one for elementary, one for middle school, one for high school. Just ideas of taking a game, incorporating it into the learning program. But there's also an empty template there to where you can obviously download it yourself, fill it in yourself, or get the ideas and create your own learning sparks rather easily. So that's one of the takeaways from the book, that this way there's, because educators really love the resources. They want to get those takeaways in their hands. And this is just one of many that Game On offers. Another one is I've started the process of collecting digital learning games that might be of interest to educators. So what I've done is I've created this digital learning game database. It's very small. I'm trying to get more people to add to it, and it's a process, but there's like at least 80 or 100 games on it right now, as is, and it's just their games. There's links to the resources on either how to access to download them. It gives you different concepts that it teaches. It tells you what platforms they are on. And it's really a great resource for planning using game-based learning. So those takeaways are there. There's a couple other ones that I'm gonna force readers to actually have to read the book.
Excellent.
But there's a bunch of takeaways in this book.
And that's what I got to tell you, Ryan, that's one of the things that I love about your books is that you have these awesome online resources, and Game On is right up there with it. From the Lesson Sparks, which one of the things I got to make sure I say is that, this is, I work with teachers on helping them understand that planning is about helping them, prepare for a class, not because they have to do it because they've been told to do it and they need to see it that way. So it helps them become creative and it helps them, use their time better and such. And these Lesson Sparks are perfect examples of that, here's this tool that they could use that would allow them to, to help integrate the game learning into their classroom, as well as these other resources that are in there. So you got to go, when you get the book, you got to go to the online resources, because incredible stuff to help you, read this section, look at the game learning and put it into your classes tomorrow, which is really cool.
Oh, I'm glad. I find that when you develop a book like this, you have to constantly be thinking of ways of supporting the reader after they're done reading, because they've taken the time to read or purchase your book. You should be able to give them plenty of things to where they're gonna want to see more, they're gonna want to learn on their own. So giving them a ton of other resources. So when people purchase my books, I want them to feel like they've purchased two or three books worth of resources. To the where they get their money's worth, because educators, they use their money wisely, and buying an educational book has to be an investment for them. They're investing in their future. They're investing in their children's futures. I want to make sure that they're spending that money spent wisely. So I'm trying to give them the resources to help their learners.
Well, I love it because it's there. I mean, that resource keeps on giving. That's what's awesome. Those online resources are excellent for helping the teacher, like I said, put them into their lesson plans, put that game-based learning in there, and get working with it tomorrow. So good stuff. So one of the things that I'd like to do before we as we get close to wrapping our talk up today is there's this question that you have at the beginning of chapter 6, which is called Digital Gaming and Assessment. And it goes like this: what if students took standardized tests by playing a digital game? Well, what do you think?
See, this is the question that really drives, and I ask my students in my teacher preparatory programs this question, and I get a lot of, usually I get a lot of flack back, like, they can't do standardized testing in a digital game type of format. And I laugh. I'm like, well, this is, we have to be careful because this is the type of mindset we now live in, that we think standardized tests have to be these dry and droll, kind of dull tasks that we kind of perform. It's almost like going to get a root canal. Gaming, game-based learning and digital gaming, a lot of the time you play, you learn, but you're also assessed constantly. If you think about the learnings, if you think about your learning program, you're teaching your students, and then, of course, you assess the learner at the end. Well, when it comes to gaming, this type of relationship, the learning and the assessment, is almost happening interchangeably and almost simultaneously. Well, that's the type of process to where, you know, can students use a standardized test? I say that it's probably going to be something that, you know, is probably nothing that's going to be even close to in the next few decades. But it really gets people to think of the mindset. Now, what I think is the most valuable use of a game for assessment is formative assessment. The type of assessment that's going to inform instruction in a cycle instead of just being the end of instruction. It's like, here's the summative assessment, you're done, let's move on to something else. Game-based learning is really tailored to formative assessment, where they play games, the instructor, the teacher, the educator, the facilitator watches and observes, this is what my students are doing well. This is what I'm seeing them struggling in. I want to attack the strategies. I want to attack the skills and concepts that they are having or they're struggling with. They can almost use it as an intervention strategy. So one day there could be a game that is used as a standardized test. It's just, and I'm sure like people will attack me, assessment gurus will attack me. What about reliability and validity? They're exploring using games as teaching with SimCity EDU. So there's an example of where is it standardized? I'm not sure yet, but the possibility does exist. A lot of our testing's now being done online. Why can't there be a type of game involved with it? Why does testing have to be something rigid? There's also a lot of clapback at standardized testing as being just this one snapshot of learning, and it has such weight in the experiences and the performance of our students forever and ever, and that's just wrong. And you know, I wouldn't say I'm anti-testing, but I'm more of like anti-labeling my students as either smart or dumb using a standardized test. That's absolutely unacceptable. That can't be the only tool that they use. So it's trying to challenge the standardized test and how it's delivered and how it's given and how it's even weighed. And to as more of the meaningful type of information for students, for my readers, when it comes to using assessment with games, the formative assessment's really the way to go.
Oh, that's awesome. You can see where it would work totally, because it's, you know, it, as they progress through it, checks to see if they're getting it and following along. I mean, that's which is what a formative assessment does. It's, you know, because if you're not using formative assessment, you're not checking to see if the kids are getting it and following along. So I definitely see that. You know, what's funny is that as you're talking about the answer to that question about could standardized tests be in that gaming world? You know, I think about when you get upper level degrees, and if you have to sit in front of a committee and discuss with them, you know, you bring in that committee and they decide, as you use all the information you've talked about in these different worlds, and you talk to them about this, and they see how well you've done to progress forward, to move forward, or, you know, the same thing in the dissertation world and stuff. I could easily see how a game could become part of that, where the scenario is created where you have to use some of that information that each of those professors represents from your departments that you chose to be on that committee. I was a history major, master's in history, and I had this five-person committee. I easily see how it fit. You know, in the sci-fi world, you have the Star Trek way back when, Gene Roddenberry put in the Kobayashi Maru. You know, it's like this whole thing, these scenarios that you could see where I could see easily how you could transform it, but it would require people letting go and letting the game be something that challenges a mindset. It's not necessarily, like you said, that you're smart or dumb. It's to see if you can deal with the scenario based upon the information that you should have gleaned over the years of the training.
Yeah, I mean, imagine learning history playing Assassin's Creed. And I know Assassin's Creed just brings up all this like blood, death, and gore, but it absolutely teaches history. I made an argument to, and I got, and just talking about Medal of Honor, the very first one that I played was Allied Assault, and it was based on the HBO Band of Brothers miniseries. In fact, it had, you know, Tom Hanks aboard as executive producer, and the game really leaned upon that expertise, Steven Spielberg and all them. They actually got accounts of real missions and real outcomes, and they were, you were immersed in the European theater, and you were doing all this different, you know, this, these war and these missions. It was objective based. You were learning history. You were, and yes, there was of course the violence. I'm not going to dispute that. but it was, I mean, very authentic. You were fighting the Axis. You were trying to win these objectives, and it was history because these experiences actually happened, and you got the first, you know, for, you got the accounts from the officers that were there, you know, so much so that it was one of the most like thrilling and engaging games. And I would say it's, I would argue as it being pretty authentic in teaching World War II history.
That's it. I think it's a great example of how it could be used. So good stuff. Well, as we're closing up, what I'd like to do is, if a listener would like to reach out to you and learn more, what would be the best way? Are you on social media? Where can someone get a copy of Game On, Using Digital Games to Transform Teaching, Learning, and Assessment?
So I'm rather active on Twitter. My name is Ryan L. Schoff on Twitter. It's RyanLSchaaf. You can find me on Twitter. I'm on there quite extensively, and I'll get back to you if you would like to aim. You can even use a hashtag Game On, or another popular one is Games for Ed, as in games, the number 4, and ED. You can actually connect with other experts in gaming, learning, and assessment. When it comes where to purchase the book is – you can purchase directly from Solution Tree if you'd like to, in hardcover or digital formats. You could go to my Amazon authors page. It has all of my books. If you're really interested in game-based learning and gamification, not only game, there's my other two books associated with digital game-based learning and gamification. There's Making School a Game Worth Playing, and there's also Using Digital Games as Assessment Instruction Tools. So you can purchase them there. I also work with InfoSavvy 21, which is a international education consultancy, with my mentors, Ian Jukes. He wrote the foreword for Game On, and his wonderful wife, Nikki Mohan, who was my co-author. Absolutely top of their game when it comes to education, when it comes to educational leadership, and also just exploring new ways of evolving education is something that will impact modern day teaching, learning, and assessment.
Excellent. And I'll have all those links. I'll have the, you know, everything that Ryan just talked about linked into my show notes. So if you're driving out there, you don't have to worry about it. Just know that you can go to the main page here, and I'll have links to InfoSavvy as 21, as well as to Twitter and some of those hashtags also that Ryan talked about, as well as links to where you can find the book. So good stuff. So in finishing up, I've got a couple questions I'd like to ask you, Ryan. And the first one goes like this. If you were given the chance to talk with an audience of teachers, what one piece of advice would you want them to remember about introducing game-based learning in their lesson plans?
My suggestion is play them and also talk to other educators. See what their ideas might be. You do not have to be a one-person army in the classroom. You don't have to be the only person. There is quite an extensive network of educators that use games, Minecraft and World of Warcraft. There's quite a bit of experts out there. Just take the time to do the research, and I promise you, you will get dividends on the instruction. Use your creativity as much as possible. I could sit in my chair, and I could spout a dozen ways of using games in a lesson plan, but don't just go by my expertise. Use your own creativity. Educators are absolutely, they can take tools and adapt them to their own situations, and many times can do it much better than I can. So take a game, figure out how you can embed it and incorporate it into instruction. That I feel like is the most practical type of integration, because educators are invested in it. They're creating resources based on it. They're playing the games with their students. Their students are learning through the games. And also, after gameplay is over, they're reflecting upon how it went and figuring out how to do it better next time. And hey, you know what? This is going to fuel another one. I'm not going to be the person that says that game-based learning is going to be for every single instructional situation at all times. No. I use this as one strategy in a rich teacher toolkit. I'm not going to use digital games every single time I teach, but absolutely when the time is right. And again, that's really up to the educator and their situation and what they decide. So that's my biggest piece of advice. Use some creativity. Take your own creative license to take what I've provided for you or what other people have provided, and go the extra step and try something different, because that's really that type of creativity has to keep on evolving. I think that's the biggest piece of advice I'd give. And also, of course, following the experts. There's myself, there's people, Steve Isaacs. I gave the hashtag Games4Ed, Games, the number 4 in Ed. That actually leads to a discussion on Twitter that goes on, that's based with a nonprofit organization called Games4Ed. And they're trying to do activities in research and in collecting and curating gaming experiences for educators. So that's another piece of advice I can offer people that might be interested in game-based learning.
Excellent advice. Love it. You mentioned Steve Isaacs. Where is he from?
He is an educator in New Jersey. He is quite active in the field of gaming, and he uses Minecraft quite extensively, but he is absolutely a guru in using games and learning, to the point to where his students are actually developing their own games and doing their own types of game design principle. And we would definitely have to follow him to keep track of what he's doing. He likes to integrate Minecraft with actual making, the maker movement.
Oh yeah.
Another wonderful educator to follow. He's actually another professor. His name is Matthew Farber, F-A-R-B-E-R. He is, I believe he now teaches at the University out in Colorado. I can't remember exactly. I think it might be the University of Denver. I'm not sure. Or it might be out in Denver. It might be the University of Colorado. I'm not sure. But he's written several books on gaming, and he writes for Edutopia on using game-based learning, and just absolutely. He's also one of the movers and shakers of game-based learning. So definitely he's somebody to follow as well.
Excellent. Thank you. So last question here. Let's talk to principals. What advice would you give school principals in supporting their teachers as they switch to the gaming mindset?
I was lucky. I had a principal that was extremely open to new ideas. Don't think of games as a waste of time. That's the one thing, is you have to really – principals either – they sometimes go into that knee-jerk reaction, and it's not an insult to principals. They just – they have their students in mind when they're doing this. So like, is this going to be a waste of time? Is it going to be a waste of money? Is it going to improve my academic program here in my school? Games, sometimes they get that that positive type of spin to them. And of course, sometimes they have a stigma associated to them. You know, there's, you know, when you think about video games, they still have a lot of negative stigmas associated with them. Like they're all about violence and pornography, and that's absolutely not the case. I could go out and find games that have that, but I could also find 50 other games that are wonderful and tried and true and developed well and then can teach. I'd like to tell the principals to try and incorporate more of a gamer's mindset into instruction, trying to get their educators to incorporate games in their centers, or games playing games, and games don't even have to be all digital. There are some really tried and true games that are non-digital and that can teach. There's card games and board games, and they absolutely are valid. They can actually teach some skills and concepts. For instance, Monopoly. Oh my goodness, Monopoly! it can teach capitalism. It can teach. It can teach economics. It can teach budgeting, and competition. So there are those types of games out there, and for every game I can give, I'm sure there's 50 other ones out there. My main suggestion is try and be open-minded when it comes to using this, because there is data, there is research out there on using game-based learning and as being a valued strategy in the classroom. And it having applications. I mean, the military would not waste time with this. The medical field would not waste time with these types of technologies and these types of approaches if it didn't work and if it didn't get the results. And they do. So that's my biggest piece of advice, is be open-minded.
Excellent. Well, Ryan, Game On, using digital games to transform teaching, learning, and assessment is an awesome tool for the classroom. I love it. It's written with a teacher who is trying to introduce game-based learning into their lessons and work with today's kid in mind. Thank you so much for this wonderful book. Wishing you the best in all that you do, and can't wait for what's coming next.
Thank you very much, Steve. Have a great one.
Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 is excited to be a member of Voice Ed Radio. Voice Ed Radio, your voice is right here. Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 is a proud member of the Education Podcast Network. Podcasts for educators, podcasts by educators. The opinions expressed on Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 are those of the guests and host. Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 is intended to share ideas, advice, and suggestions for classroom teachers and school administrators. Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 is produced for educational purposes. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll share it with your friends.